Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Eric, one of Jason's old college roommates, and you're listening to the Surely You Can't Be Serious podcast. Over to you, boys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Surely You Can't Be Serious podcast. We are here today for album number 4 of 5 that we are covering from 1994. We are going to be talking about Live Throwing Copper today. We have previously covered Green Day, Dookie. We've previously covered Bush, 16 Stone, and we have previously covered Weezer, the Blue Album. And we still have Collective Soul, the Blue Album, to cover on our next episode.
That's right.
We've had some great guest hosts, and we have another great guest host today, friend of the podcast, longtime listener, longtime Patreon member, Mr. Brad Moore. How you doing, Brad?
I'm doing good, guys. How are you?
Good, man. How's life treating you down there in Louisiana?
Like I ran over its dog. No, seriously. It's good. I'm glad to be back. Finally, glad we were able to do one of these again. Sorry, I had to flake out on the Patreon episode when we did Epic.
That's all right, man. No problem. You're a working man.
So covering these albums from 94 has led us not only to pick these 5 albums, but Jason and I just recently decided once we're done with this, we're going to do our top 5 of 1994, which I'm super excited about because this year was an amazing year for music. And it's a great opportunity to be able to listen to these guys talk about the albums that they made 30 years ago. And one of the guys, you know, we just finished Bush 16 Stone, and listening to Gavin Rossdale talk, you know, I had it in my head that, you know, he's kind of a pretty boy. He's just the most down-to-earth, friendly guy in the world.
Okay.
And then the same thing with Live. I kind of had this image in my head of Ed Kowalczyk that was, you know, he's kind of a stuck-up intellectual guy. I'm listening to him, and he's just the most easygoing, friendly, you know.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just love it. And then as he's talking, he's like, well, you know, the interviewer is like, well, who have you met, you know, in the industry that you've bonded with? And he's like, oh, Gavin Rossdale and I have the best time in the world. So these guys are actually friends.
That's cool.
They're close friends. But Gavin Rossdale, when I was listening to him talk, he said this wonderful thing. I wrote it down. I forgot to mention in our Bush episode. But he said, there's only 12 notes. There's just an infinite way to arrange them. From Mozart to Slipknot, they're all using the same 12 notes. And I just thought, that's exactly right. And then listening to Ed Kowalczyk talk, he was like, 94 was just one of those years where you had all of these incredible albums, but they were all very unique. Like everything sounded different than everything else. And he said, within just a few years after that, everything began to be homogenized and sound the same. And so it was really this, I mean, 94 was kind of the beginning of the end of things being the way we grew up with them for, you know, the 20th century.
I would agree. That's kind of the last place I've planted my flag in the music world was 94, 95. Hey, by the way, before we get started, he was a little bit late to the podcast today. Brad sent us a text and said, hey, we are talking about 3 o'clock central, right? And I texted back and I said, I alone at this moment.
Good. That was good. It was only 3:05, by the way, and I drove an hour to get here. A little break here. Okay, so guys, tell me your experience with this album. We talked about some of these other albums, and I mentioned that Bush was the first one that I had that album back in 1995 and played it all the time. This is another one that I had in 95, and I played it all the time. I loved this CD. I consider it possibly top 10 albums of all time when we're talking about albums that are flawless from beginning to end.
Wow.
You know, put 10 by Pearl Jam in there, put Joshua Tree by U2 in there. I mean, there are very few albums that have no skippers, no fillers, just good, good music from beginning to end. And to me, Throwing Copper is one of those albums.
Brad, what's your history with this one?
Well, you know, I had a roommate at the time. I've only been in Louisiana a short time when this album came out, and his name was Spencer Caldwell. And I walked in one day and he was playing this album. He had gotten it. I don't know where he heard it first, but I Alone was playing. I'm like, what is this? And he's like, man, it's live. I'm like, live where? Like, this is a live show.
Right.
You saw? He said, no, the band is called Live. I'm like, this is phenomenal. He said, yeah, the whole album's like this. It's great. So he said, you got to sit down and listen to it. And I said, all right, let's do it. And we listened to the whole thing on that stereo right there.
Not, are those awesome. Sherwin Vega speakers? What in the world?
They're Sony speakers. I've had them since I was 16.
Wow.
And some of the components have changed, but I gave it to my son, bought him a turntable to go with it, and it's still kicking. That thing is built to last.
That's nice. Fantastic. Nice. So for me, I knew the hits from this. So they were unavoidable on radio. But this album took a massive step forward to me when a catastrophic event happened in Oklahoma City in 1995.
Yeah, we will definitely talk about that.
That's right. I want to hold that story until a little bit later.
Yeah.
So this album was released April 26, 1994. This went 8 times platinum in the U.S. April of 94, we had a couple people die. You had Richard Nixon pass away in April of 94. He was 81 from a stroke. You also had Kurt Cobain, who took his own life in April of 94. So a couple of significant deaths in April of 94.
Okay, first song out of the gate is a song I love called The Dam at Otter Creek.
When all is left to do is reflect on what's been done. This is where sadness breathes, the sadness of everyone. Just like when the guys with the dam at Otter Creek and all the water backed up deep enough to dive.
Okay, so before we started going on this one, I texted Jason and I was like, okay, I want you to try to guess what my favorite track on this CD is. And he was like, I Alone. I was like, nope. He's Lightning Crashes. I'm like, nope. He's like, Selling the Drama? No. Is it Dam at Otter Creek? Yes. Dam at Otter Creek is my favorite track on this whole CD. And I love every song.
Very hard to pick a favorite track on this CD.
This one just has such a unique sound, the build that they have at the beginning of this. I mean, I have never been fortunate enough to see live, but I can just imagine like the shadow silhouettes of these guys moving across the stage as this builds and builds at the beginning of this song.
It's definitely like a concert kickoff song, right?
Oh, heck yeah.
As the curtain's still up, you hear the hum and the guitar. By the way, that guitar riff, Chad Taylor said that it like came to him in a dream. He also heard this like hum of power cables, and so he had a little journal by his bed, and he rolled over and he wrote, High Tension Power Lines. So apparently Otter Creek is a tributary of the Susquehanna River in York, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, the Susquehanna River is a place where they would literally make dams. They would make these dams so that they could let the water build up deep enough to dive. But what resulted, you know, because these are just dumb kids doing this, is that quite a few people died diving into these waters. So you mentioned York, Pennsylvania. That is where these guys all grew up. They met in middle school when they were like 13 years old. We got Ed Kowalczyk on vocals and rhythm guitar.
Yep.
We got Chad Taylor on lead guitar and backing vocals. Patrick Dahlheimer on bass and Chad Gracie on drums and backing vocals. But these guys all went to middle school together. They all went to high school at the William Penn Senior High School in York, Pennsylvania, which was a blue-collar town, just like we've talked about a few of these bands, including Green Day, where you had a giant Harley-Davidson factory and a giant Caterpillar factory across the street from each other, and pretty much everybody in the town worked there, except for Ed's dad, who apparently was a high school teacher nearby.
You were talking about that opening guitar riff. Apparently, when Chad Taylor was playing it, Ed walked in and heard it and was like, what is that? And he's like, I don't know. Something I've got and I don't know what it is. And he's like, keep going. And apparently he just spouted off several lines of lyrics right there.
I heard that when he brought it to the rest of the band, he said, okay, guys, Chad and I have come up with this deal. What we're going to do is gradually ratchet up the intensity and the speed. Apparently they also recorded this song in a studio with massive bay windows during a lightning storm.
I think they turned all the lights off, didn't they?
They turned off all the lights and it was in the middle of a lightning storm. The studio had these huge windows. This is in Cannon Fall, Minnesota, and it added to the intensity, kind of the drama of the song, and they got it all in one take.
Fantastic. Yeah, no, I can't even, I mean, that's perfect. What a perfect image for this song. It makes it even better in my mind.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty cool. You know, you're talking about how these guys got started in the eighth grade. Well, Patrick, Chad, and the other Chad, the drummer and the guitarist, they played in an instrumental band called First Aid.
Yep.
Ed Kowalczyk joined as the singer in the eighth grade, and he auditioned by singing
Duran Duran.
Duran Duran. That's right.
Yeah. He auditioned with the band at the behest of his music teacher. Their eighth grade music teacher was like, you guys should try to do something together and do something for the eighth grade talent show, which is how they got together. And they actually credit, I mean, it's kind of crazy in this type of town that we've talked about. They credit some of the music teachers that they had in their high school with being very influential on teaching them about musical theory and exposing them to different artists and composers that really influenced how they play.
Once they got together, they changed their name to Public Affection, and they played songs by the Violent Femmes, REM, U2, and Bryan Adams.
Nice.
He said their heroes were U2 after reading The Unforgettable Fire.
Yeah, I got a story on that, actually, but I think we need to move on to the next song first. This is song number 2 on the album, one you might have heard of, called Selling the Drama.
Into love, the God. Into fear, the flame. Into burn. A crowd that has a name. And to write.
So obviously a lot of religious symbolism going on here. To love a God and to fear a flame, obviously in reference to Christianity and God and hell. To right a wrong is in the Hindu tradition. To meek or strong is a play on the Beatitudes of Jesus. And then scream it from the wall, the wailing wall from the Jewish faith. So he's got all kinds of stuff going on here. He really had gotten into a philosophy at the time that he was writing these songs by a guy named Krishnamurtis. The idea was that behind this philosophy that this guy had was that you shouldn't be worshiping an individual. You are surrounded by things that should impact who you are and find out the truth within yourself instead of looking out to others. This was back when he was 18 years old and writing songs.
Yeah, this song was the first single released February 94. And when I say single, it wasn't really a single. It wasn't a physical single that they sold, but it was the first song released to radio stations. Once again, in order to drive album sales, they did not release physical singles.
And they sold that drama 8 million times.
Good point. Good point.
They did.
This reached number 1 on the modern rock charts and number 43 on the Hot 100.
Okay, so you mentioned that this hit number 1 on the modern rock charts, and it didn't even hit the top 40 on the Hot 100.
43,
It only got to 43. So inspired by my friend Jason Colvin, I thought, well, let me go see what the top 10 was that this thing only made it to number 43. And my mind was blown, and not in a good way. All right, are you guys ready for this?
This is the top 10 that is blocking this from getting up there. Okay, keep going.
Right, so number 10, If You Go by John Cicada. Huh? All right, number 9, Funkdefied by DeBrat. Number 8, Back and Forth by Aaliyah. Mm-hmm. Number 7, Can You Feel the Love Tonight by Elton John. That's the first one of a glimmer of hope right there, right? Okay, Fantastic Voyage by Coolio at number 6. And number 5, Don't Turn Around by Ace of Base, the song that made me want to claw my ears off in 1994.
Don't turn around.
Oh my gosh. Number 4, Anytime, Anyplace by Janet Jackson. No. Number 3, Regulate by Warren G and Nate Dogg.
There you go.
A memorable song, but not something that should have been 40 places ahead of this song.
Okay.
Number 2, Stay by Lisa Loeb and 9 Stories. And at number 1, in its 10th week at number 1, I Swear by All For One. There was something wrong with the listening public or with the Billboard Hot 100 in this time. I don't know what was going on, but there's no way that those songs should have been in the top 10, and this one only hit 43.
10 weeks at number 1.
At least 10 weeks. This was just the 10th week. It may have gone on.
Wow.
I don't know how long it spent there, but it was there a long time. So back to U2. Obviously, U2 had a bunch of religious symbolism as well. If you want to go back, was that season one that we did?
It was, yeah.
Yeah, so way back in season one, we covered U2 with Joshua Tree. Fantastic episode. I love it. As I said, it's one of those albums too. But 1987, Ed goes to a concert with a friend of his, and it's U2. They paid $60, went over to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, watched from the nosebleed section, and he was so impacted that as they walked away, he said, "I'm going to do what Bono and that band does, or I'm going to die trying."
That's cool. I love that.
Yeah. Of course, he gets Unforgettable Fire, shows it to the rest of the band, and they feel like they're reading their own story when they read that book.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
It's great. This was recorded at the same studio as Nirvana's In Utero, kind of a big deal at the moment. And this music video is the last one we have where Ed has long hair.
He looked like Benny from Benny and June. He had the long hair. He had the John Lennon circle glasses.
Yeah.
And he had that hat and trench coat like Johnny Depp from Benny and June.
And then he just buzzed it all off. So now he's Mr. Clean, right? He's Q-Ball.
Well, he had rat tail there for a while. It was buzzed except for the rat tail.
Oh, I forgot about the rat tail.
Which apparently he kept. Like, I guess once he cut that off finally, he was like, "Oh, in this to the wall."
Nice. Nice.
Brad, what are your thoughts on this song?
I mean, it's another one of the great ones. I mean, it's such a good song. It hooks you in. And a lot of these songs, this is one in particular, I feel like Ed's voice almost acts like an instrument. You know, he can go so many different ranges. He can go high, he can go low, he can scream with the best of them. But if you kind of listen to everything behind the instruments, you still hear his voice. And it's, like I said, it's almost like an additional instrument in the band. And I think that's one of the things that really hooked me on live to begin with, was just the musicianship was such at a high level. And his voice is just, you know, incredible. Yeah, he has such a dynamic voice that the only guy that I think compares to him that came around after that was Brent Smith of Shinedown.
All right, well, let's move on to the next song on the album. Song number 3, this song is called I Alone.
It's easier not to be what measure these things by your brains. I sank into Eden with you, alone in the church by and by.
This one hit number 6 on the Modern Rock Tracks. Live played both at the Woodstock 94 festival that we talked about when we talked about Green Day and the Mudslinging.
Yep. So actually, Collective Soul, which we're going to talk about next week.
Yeah, Collective Soul was there. Selling the Drama was actually the first song on the first disc of the Woodstock 94 double disc set. So obviously they were doing well at the time. So well that they invited them back for Woodstock 99, where they played this song.
To leave you there.
Nice. I read that this song, there are elements of this song that is based on Luke chapter 8, verses 22 through 25.
Yeah, I listened to him talk about composing this song. He said, you know, the lyric came into his head of it's easier not to be wise. And he just like, he was like, wow, that just kind of summed up this really big thing. And then later he came up with the I sank into Eden with you. And he's like, gosh, these, you know, I'm really happy with these lyrics, but obviously they don't rhyme. So he did the same thing. He did the same thing that Mutt Lang and Def Leppard did when they're writing Pour Some Sugar on Me. He scattered some lyrics, and that's how he came up with And Measure These Things by Your Brains, Alone in the Church by and by.
Well, and like I said earlier, this is the first song I ever heard by live, and it was just such a good song. And there's so many different changes in tempo, and it's one of those songs, you know, it's up there with me, like with Stairway to Heaven and, you know, Tom Sawyer and whatever else, Hotel Caller. It's a perfect song. It really is in all aspects.
Wow.
It's not the best song on the album, but it's that kind of song. It has that kind of reach.
For our listening audience who doesn't know Brad as well as we do, putting it up next to Tom Sawyer is a big deal. He's literally wearing a Rush t-shirt in front of us right now.
That's high praise.
Despite being their third album, they did not have any money when he wrote this. Like, his dad knew a guy who had a barn that they could live in. And so that's when he wrote this song, living in a barn in the middle of nowhere. He was I Alone.
So I sent you guys a link today as I was driving over here to record.
For, I wonder what that was.
For a restaurant. Yeah. Okay. So because I was listening and I was wondering, I was like, huh, I wonder if this is still a restaurant around. But it, the name of the restaurant is, because it's still there, Grand Falloon's Tavern there in York, Pennsylvania. They started this band when he was 13 years old. At 14 years old, he got a job as a dishwasher there and continued to work there because he said, like, I needed money to buy a guitar. And so he continued to work there through the time that they released Metal Jewelry. Like, he's like, we still didn't have any money by the time Metal Jewelry came out. So I was still working over there. So he's, you know, from 14 to 21 or whatever they were when Metal Jewelry came out, he was working over at Grand Falloon's Tavern.
We need to go there. That would be cool.
Heck yeah.
Awesome place to visit.
Yeah.
Before we move on from this one, if it were not for one particular memory with a song, this would be my favorite. So this is my second favorite song on the album.
Yeah. I mean, you pointed to the religious imagery in here. Obviously, it's throughout the songs, but just for the one you mentioned, the part in the Bible, it's the lyrics of the song is, you'll need them. Your boat is at sea. Your anchor is up. You've been swept away. And the greatest of teachers won't hesitate but to leave you there by yourself, chained to fate. That is all about the moment that Christ was out on the walking on the water and Peter went out to him during the storm. All right. Yep. So that moves us on to the next song on the album. This one is called Iris. The pencils of my knuckles.
But the beauty of this vision alone, just like yesterday's sunset. It's been converted by the sentimental.
Love the intro to this song. I love the fact that we just went from Bible verses to a blowjob. I like the way my hand looked on your head in the presence of my knuckles. I like the way my hand looked on your head in the presence of my struggle. Well, I don't think there's really any doubt about what we're talking about in this scenario.
I mean, he is a young man. So there you go.
Yes. Now, what's interesting is he does then still, again, throw it back to the Bible. He says, the Felix of your truth will always break it. This is a reference to Antoninus Felix in the Bible, the guy who is so tired of listening to Paul talk about Jesus that he put him in jail. That's that Felix that he's referring to.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. This is another song that was performed at Woodstock 94, which I have a feeling we're going to talk a little bit more about next week.
I'm spiking the proverbial Doc Martin. This is my favorite song.
Oh, heck yeah.
Spiking the Doc Martin.
So yeah, I always like this one. It just has, I go back to the tempo changes, and I mean, it slows down, it kicks back up, and it just rocks out at the end of the song, and I've just always loved it. I remember listening to that whole album through the first time, and it got to the songs. Like, man, we were only four songs in. I mean, what else have they got on this album that could be even remotely good? Little did I know, the rest of the entire album's good, but this has always been one that stuck out to me. I always loved the song. My favorite, for sure.
That's awesome. Yeah, I love this song, and you know, unsurprisingly, this is yet another band who has cited the Pixies as an influence to them, and obviously this is that same let's be quiet, let's be loud, let's be quiet, let's be loud moment. I can't get over how good the guitar riff sounds on this with the powerful dun 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 dun, dun stop. Dun dun dun, dun 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 stop. It's an amazing song that doesn't sound like anything that we've heard on the album so far. They're using those 12 notes the way they should.
All right, move on to my favorite song on the album, a song that was huge the summer of 95. That song is called Lightning Crashes.
Crashes, a new mother cries.
So Ed wrote this song on an acoustic guitar in his bedroom, in his brother's bedroom, actually, just before he moved out of the house. It was dedicated to a friend that they had in school named Barbara Lewis, who was killed by a drunk driver in 1993. But she had donated her organs, and her liver went to save the life of a 10-month-old baby. Now, you watch the video on this one, which is absolutely amazing, and you think it's all about the loss of a child in childbirth. But Ed has said, no, what he had really envisioned on this was a hospital where in one room you have an old person who is dying, and then in another room a new life is being born. This goes back to this philosophy of Krishnamurti that he had followed, of living life from a place of selflessness and humility and finding the truth within. Now, what happens ultimately with this song is something surprising and a weird coincidence. I'll let Jason tell you about that.
The angel closes her eyes. The confusion that was here belongs now to the baby down the hall.
So on April 19th, 1995, the Oklahoma City bombing occurred. Something strange happened. There was a DJ in Oklahoma City who took this song and added like news clippings and sound clips and created a version of this song with all of those, President Clinton speaking and victims talking. And for me, it went viral around the world. I'm surprised that not as many people knew about it as I did, but it was a big, big deal in Oklahoma City. And I was living in Norman, which is about 20 miles south of Oklahoma City at the time.
One of these concussions you can feel in your chest.
Pull us out of our chairs onto the floor.
It could have come caving in on me at any point in time, but I never gave that one thought.
I'll never want to look at anything like that again in my life.
This moment she's been waiting for.
Of the 41 children who had been enrolled in the daycare center, some of them were burned beyond recognition.
Might have lost my 3-year-old daughter.
It's unbelievable.
The angel opens her eyes.
Some of them were so upset they couldn't look down at the children they were carrying.
I remember that day incredibly well. Me and my two roommates, Eric Metoyer and Cameron Eckert, rushed to Oklahoma City to give blood. And Cameron and I, because of our blood type, they had so many people up there giving blood, they wouldn't take us. But my friend was O negative. They rushed him right to the front of the line. And you could still see the smoke from the building. And it's just one of those weird events in your life where this catastrophic event happens. And then a song in popular culture attaches itself to that event. And to me, these things are just totally interlinked. So every time I hear of this song, it just makes me think about all those people who lost their lives.
Incredible stuff. So here's the interesting twist on things. And they talked about this, like the guys in the band were kind of mystified. They described it as surreal to have this heartbreaking event be connected to something that they wrote. But as you mentioned early on, this album was released in April of 94. It had been out for over a year whenever the Oklahoma City bombing happened. It had started to decline in sales by May 6th of 95, just 2 weeks after the bombing. It was the biggest selling album in the world. And I have no doubt that it had something to do with that connection to the Oklahoma City bombing.
You want to hear the top five that week?
Sure. Yeah. What was the top five on May 5th, 1994?
Well, so that I found that totally incredible as well. Like it jumps back to the number one spot.
Yeah.
So number five was Me Against the World by Tupac.
Albums. I'm talking albums.
I'm talking albums. Yeah, best-selling albums for the week of May 5th, 1995.
Yep.
Number four was the Lion King soundtrack.
Okay. Yeah.
Which was huge, right?
Right.
Number three was Cracked Rear Window by Hootie and the Blowfish.
I had it.
It was massive.
Yep.
Number two was the Friday soundtrack.
Okay.
And then number one was Throwing Copper.
Yeah.
By the way, this song did not have a physical single release. So based on airplay alone on radio stations, it reached number 12 on the Hot 100. Pretty incredible. It was number one on modern rock charts for 9 weeks and was the third single. An incredible and one that still gives me chills.
Brad, what are your thoughts, man?
No, you're just talking about that. Because anything, I didn't realize there was that connection there. I've always loved the song, but I guess about 6-7 years ago, I actually went to Oklahoma City, went to the bombing museum. And I remember when we're sitting in there and they're playing, I guess, the meeting they're having at the water department next door or whatever. And you could hear the bomb go off and everything just goes quiet. And I mean, it literally, you know, just sends chills up and down your spine. I know it's not really related to the album, but I can imagine living there at the time and having that create that, you know, connection to that song has to be, you know, something that'll never leave. I mean, because even going to that museum and, you know, seeing all the empty chairs out there outside and all that, I mean, I can't imagine. I really can't.
My good friend Roman was working at the University of Oklahoma Health Science Center as a hospital area where they train students and they, you know, to be doctors and nurses and stuff. And he said when it went off, he looked out and every doctor like on campus plus students was racing on foot to the building. Incredible. In 2021, Billboard ranked Lightning Crashes as the 70th biggest hit in the history of mainstream rock charts. Okay. Nope. I hate to move on so quickly from this one, but next song on the album is called Top. Okay, so right after a song where we mentioned the word placenta, we have a song about Hitler.
This song's about Hitler?
They mentioned Hitler in it. Oh, Hitler in a robe of truth.
I think he had to come out several times and say,
I'm not a Nazi.
Glorify Hitler.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when you shave your head after the album comes out, you got some splaining to do. Yeah, so this one has, again, some more deeply philosophical lyrics in it. Did I mention that the producer on this one is Jerry Harrison from Talking Heads?
No, you didn't.
Okay. So the producer, he did Metal Jewelry as well. Right. And so when they first found out that they were going to get a producer, all they said is it's a guy from Talking Heads. And Ed's like, David Byrne.
Yeah.
Like the only guy that I know from Talking Heads. And he's like, oh no, not him. Okay. He plays the keyboards. All right, cool. But as it turned out, they hit it off very well. They would go have lunch and talk about their philosophical ideas, and that highly influenced his writing of a lot of these songs. But Jerry at the time was also a rock star. And so in 93, he gets them backstage to Nirvana in their In Utero tour. We mentioned this album is recorded in the same place as In Utero. They're excited. You know, they're still just kids who haven't made it yet. And they're getting to go listen to Nirvana, who were a big influence on them. They go backstage. They go into the dressing room, which he described as gigantic, as opposed to the ones at CBGB's, which is painted, right. Painted plywood, right? He said, but when he got in there, it was just Dave and Chris. That was it. Like, they were looking at some pictures. They weren't really interested. And they keep waiting around for Kurt. And then it was like, well, I guess he's not going to come. And he's like, okay, well, we got to go. The show's going to begin. And he's like, okay, I got to pee real quick. He goes to the bathroom. He's taking a piss. Somebody steps up next to him at the urinal. He turns and looks, and it's Kurt Cobain. He said he saw him there. He talked to him for a half a second, and then he knew he was going on stage. But before he sees him on stage, he sees him curled up in a fetal position, like on the side of the stage before they go on. And he's like, oh my gosh, there's something wrong with this guy. They go out in the audience, and he said it's the best show he's ever seen in his life.
Oh my gosh, that's crazy.
Yeah.
I want to hear that conversation. What's up, dude?
Hey.
Eyes on the pee spot. Okay, this is the first song where I'm like, this one really didn't do it for me. I mean, you got killer, 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 and then this one's like, meh.
It's less amazing as the rest of the songs on the album, but I still love it. I absolutely love the song.
It's a good song, but when you're comparing it to the ones that, you know, preceded it, it's, you know, doesn't quite have the teeth that the rest of them do. But like, you know, D just said, it's still a great song.
The next song on the album is called All Over You.
Thank you.
gosh, they're so good. These songs are so freaking good. And this is as close as we get to a love song from live so far. Listening to Ed talk, I got almost the exact same story that we got from Billy Joe Armstrong. He had somebody take him to a REM concert, and he would listen to The Cure and Husker Du and was like, wow, these guys are writing lyrics that are not just your standard I love you lyrics. These are songs with lyrics with something behind them. This is the kind of music that I want to write. And so that's how we get this. But even with his love songs, like he almost sounds angry when he's singing these lyrics, but it's so powerful what he's putting out there for us. All over you, all over me.
Fourth single on the album, released December of 94. This reaches number 4 on the modern rock charts, number 2 on mainstream rock charts. This is a banger. I love it.
It's a great song. I think a lot of people, when I was reading, thought it was about prostitution. It said, lay me down, pay me now. You know, and it's kind of hard not to draw that same conclusion. But then you listen to Ed talk about it and you realize it's a little bit more than that. But yeah, it's a great song. It's said right up there with the rest of them. It's another just great song to rock out to, and they just keep going.
I thought that too. So we got Bible verses, we got blowjobs, we've got prostitution.
You got it all.
Hitler. Well, don't forget Hitler.
And Hitler, right? Placentas, right? But he said he wrote this song when he was about, 21? He said that this is the first time in their life where everybody was now really interested in women. And he said it kind of broke up their boyhood solidarity. This song was used in The X-Files in season 3. Shout out to Def Dave. Also used in the movie Love and Sex, starring Jon Favreau and Famke Janssen.
Okay.
Majors.
I might check that out.
Anything else on this one, Brad?
Nope.
Okay, hit stop on your tape player. Kick it out. Flip it over for side 2. And the next song is called...
Are we allowed to say the name of this next song with our PG-13 audience? Shit Town.
The Weaver. Street from me. The crackheads, they live down the street from me.
So Ed said after they released this song, they were not very welcome in their hometown anymore.
What? What are you talking about?
Yeah, apparently he lived down the street from the Weavers and up the street from the Crackheads, but it was okay because nobody mowed the grass and you couldn't see him anyway.
I heard that he wanted to use the Cleavers, like
June and
like
Ward,
like the Beeve. Yeah, but they couldn't get permission to do that. But I did hear that he said from the stage, don't ever go there. Do not ever go unless you like York Peppermint Patties or Harley Davidson's. And I'm like, I like both of those.
Yeah, sure. I could do that.
I don't know. I don't really, I like the song. I just don't really like the sentiment of trashing your hometown too much.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but maybe you had a good hometown to grow up
in. I like my hometown.
Yeah. You didn't grow up next to the smokestacks of the big factories in town and live down the street from the Crackheads.
I lived down the street from Mazio's Pizza.
Sounds much better.
It was nice.
Okay, so here's the story on how they got out of the shit town, okay?
Yes.
All right, so they started playing local gigs, and they ultimately, you know, they're like, hey, we're doing well enough. We should start charging people at the door. They charged $4 a head. $4 a head.
Yes.
And sold out a 400-seat club and had to turn people away because they had gotten so big locally, right? And of course, now I say locally, like they lived in York, which is a 2-hour drive from just about anywhere you want to go, like New York City, Washington, D.C., all that other stuff, right?
Okay.
And so they're like, hey, we need management. And they wanted this guy named David Sestak to be their manager, but he wouldn't take their calls. He was like, I don't know who you are. Stop bugging me, blah, 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 blah. So Chad Taylor, the guitarist, daddy steps in. Chad Taylor's dad calls up David Sestak and says, listen, you're either going to listen to these guys or you're going to make the biggest mistake of your career.
Wow.
And that was enough to get him to listen. Like helicopter dad came in and made things happen. And when David Sestak listened to him, he was like, you know what? You guys are good, but you need an album. So what do they do? This is great. they sold junk bonds to their friends and family for an interest in their first album.
Oh my God.
For like, you know, $100 a piece or whatever, they're selling an interest, which of course nobody ever got paid anything from this.
Of course.
But they raised $10,000 to make their first album, which was The Death of a Dictionary, when they were still under the name they had before, which was Public Affection.
Right.
They pressed about 2,000 copies. It's kind of hard to find now, The Death of a Dictionary, but it was a great success. And so they're like, okay, let's see if we can give this band thing a go. Now, Ed had a scholarship to American College. Like, they were like, we'll pay for your entire tuition, everything. And he said, I deferred it for 2 years. I said, we will give ourselves 2 years to make it as a band, which is the same story that we've already told with Weezer.
Weezer.
Yeah.
He had a scholarship.
Yeah. And fortunately, in that 2 year time period, they did very well. The Death of a Dictionary got a Washington Post review where the writer said they may be able to take over the modern rock scene from U2 and REM.
Wow.
That gets them gigs at CBGB's, which gets them funding from a record company named Giant. They did a demo with Jay Healy. And then Jay Healy, by the way, produced John Mellencamp. But then once they had the demo, Giant didn't like it so much, but Radioactive Records did like it. They signed the band, had them change their name to Hoity Toity, I guess, and they literally drew the name live out of a hat.
Can we talk about how that is like the worst name of a band? I'm serious, because when you Google it, you know, you type in live Lightning Crashes, you know what you're going to get? A bunch of live versions of Lightning Crashes.
Well, maybe. Just maybe back in 1994, like 15 years before Google existed, they didn't have the foresight to know people would be searching for their songs on YouTube.
That's fair. That's fair.
It searched live parentheses band.
By the way, you know who else went to American University?
Who's that?
Catherine Colvin.
Really?
She went one semester. Yep.
Wow. She could have gone with Ed Kowalczyk.
All
right, time to move on to the next song on the album. This one is called TBD.
In the moment I was losing my head and reading to
This is like a break song. This is like, we've been hitting you hard. Okay, now we're going to give you something mellow. And first lyrics in this song are, in the moment I was losing my head, reading too much and losing my head, and I was reaching forward, I was already there, reading too much and losing my head. This information caused a cut in the line. Now I'm remembering God and reading too much. This is in reference to the author Aldous Huxley, who wrote A Brave New World, who was a staunch atheist, who, while he was on his deathbed and on a morphine drip, his wife read him the Tibetan Book of the Dead. That's why we have the name.
I've always liked this song. I love the bass intro. It's just kind of slow. It's kind of relaxing, but it's just, it's a very smooth intro to this song. And it's a total departure of everything else that's on the album. But I like it. It's a really, really good song.
This could easily be on the makeout list of 1995. This is a smooth, you know, if you're in the pool room at 2 a.m., this song comes on and the girl is still checking you out, this is where you go over and start talking.
I can see that. I can see that. Okay, moving on to the next song on the album. That song is called Stage. This is a crowd slammer. This is a mosh pit song.
Yeah, this is them doing punk rock, which is, Ed's voice might just be too good for punk rock, but man, it's a banger for sure.
Well, from one extreme to the other after TBD.
Exactly.
If I had to pick one song that's probably my least favorite on there, it's probably this one.
You're not a punk rock guy, though.
No, I'm not a punk rock guy, so that's just kind of a little bit too much like that. I don't hate it, but when you compare it to everything else in the album, if it's a skipper, this is the one for me.
So, lyric in the song, he was a rock and roll messiah and she was known for her child care. You guys remember when Courtney Love admitted that she did heroin while she was pregnant?
Yeah.
That's what these two lines are about. Courtney Love and Kurt Cobain ironically released the month he commits suicide.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I love it. Okay. That makes the song more interesting to me.
Yeah.
This is the moment in the concert when Brad and I are going to go get drinks.
I'm jumping in the mosh
pit. You guys enjoy the mosh pit. Yeah. You guys thirsty? I did hear, I thought this was a great quote. Ed Kowalczyk said, at 13 years old, they believed that they were going to rule the world. And he said, right before they had to go to college, they landed that record deal, which we talked about, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So they made a video for $5,000 and he couldn't believe it, but MTV put it on smack between Michael Jackson and Madonna.
Okay. Yeah. So that one, Radioactive Records ends up producing Metal Jewelry. Their big hit, if you want to call it that, I mean, his big hit on college radio was called Operation Spirit because college radio played it and MTV had it in pretty high rotation. That album sold 500,000 copies. That's not too bad.
That's gold, man.
Yeah, that's not too bad for the first album under a different name. But these guys, you know, I read something. This is 2024 report that credits this album as the beginning of the post-grunge movement.
Okay.
I hadn't really thought about that before, but like with grunge, you've got a lot of nihilism and angst. And so what is the post-grunge reaction to that? Well, if we're talking about this, it's spiritualism and a hope for joy. Like that's really the message. I mean, he's got some intellectual messages behind his lyrics that are more promising and hopeful than what we've had in the past.
Okay, moving on to the next song. This song is called Waitress.
Come on, baby, leave some change behind. She was a bitch, but I don't care. She brought her food out on time. Wore a funky bread in her hair. Come on, baby, leave some change behind. She was a bitch, good enough to leave some change. Everybody's good enough for some change. The girl's got family, she needs cash.
So this is a little less deep than the past songs have been.
All right, guys, hear me out. I got a great song. It's about tipping your waitress because everybody's good enough for some change.
Listen, at the time that I was listening to this album on heavy rotation on my CD player, I was working as a waiter, and so I loved the song. I loved it. She's got a funky bread in her hair. I was just like, oh yeah, I know that girl. She is an effing bitch, but leave her some change. Because here's what you know as a waiter. If somebody leaves you change, that is to say much less than the standard 15 to 20% at the time.
Right.
That means they didn't forget to tip you. They just thought you sucked.
Take this home for me. Yeah. Brad, what are your thoughts on this one?
I was a waiter when this song came out too, and went into a college student, and we've all been there, you know. I did it just because that's what they do, but then, you know, other people deserve the change. But yeah, he didn't mince words in this song at all.
Yeah.
Maybe he was thinking of somebody at the tavern that he worked at.
That's right.
In York, Pennsylvania. Grand Falloons.
Grand Falloons.
Which I really want to go visit now. I really want to go.
I've been thinking about York Peppermint Patties all day.
I just want to meet this waitress because I'm sure she's still working there.
Hey, everybody's good enough for some change. All right. We ready for the next one?
Moving on.
Next song on the album is called Pillar of Davidson.
This is a beautiful song to me. This song puts me in a very calm and easy mood, and it's another song about their hometown, but a little kinder this time.
To me, it's one of the more underrated songs on the album, and it took me a while to warm up to it because it's so slow at first, but then it gets in the chorus and it's a little bit, you know, more up-tempo, brighter, I guess you could say. But yeah, I've always liked this song. It's a really, really good one. It doesn't buried kind of deep in the album. Not a lot of people talk about it, but it's a really good song.
So I mentioned earlier that everybody pretty much in the town worked at one of two factories, one making Harley Davidson parts,
right?
The other one making Caterpillars. That's how we get the name of the song, Pillar of Davidson. Oh yeah. I didn't know it either until Ed turned me on. I was like, oh.
That makes me like it more.
Pretty creative.
I did like his quote on this one. Ed Kowalczyk said, "It's a song that you can sing and maybe feel a little bit less lonely." I dig it.
Yeah, love it.
Wow.
So, of note, if you had the vinyl, if you were still buying vinyl records in 1994 and 1995, what? You didn't get this song. I had the CD, so I got this song, but this was not on the vinyl pressing of 94.
Were people buying records in 94? I don't think anybody was, hardly.
Well, I guess so.
I was.
Yeah. Cool. Moving on to the next one. This song is called White Discussion. Okay, this is the fifth and final single on the album.
Yeah, and as the disciples of this disenchanting discourse continue to dampen the day. That's solid songwriting right there, guy. That is awesome.
It's just kind of a poking fun at political correctness. It's a good one. It's another one just like the one before it. It's kind of buried deep in the album, but it's such a really good song. Yeah, he really put a lot of time and thought into those lyrics. I mean, not many people can pull off that and make it sound good.
This is my favorite song on side two.
Nice.
Yeah, I really like this one. You know, he samples that Colorado preacher.
Yes.
Who was delivering.
I prepared you.
Delivering a sermon on the end of the world. And Ed recorded him just because he liked his voice.
Yeah.
Sam Kinison type.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
This song was used in the movie Virtuosity, 1995, starring Denzel Washington and Russell Crowe.
Clock is finally dead.
Oh, I missed that one.
It's kind of a junk science fiction movie.
Okay. Well, let me ask you, did you guys see Fight Club?
Yes.
So as I'm watching Fight Club in the theater, there's a scene where they're Helena Bonham Carter and Ed Norton are talking in a little diner and a waiter comes up. And as I'm watching the movie, I'm like, God, that looks like the lead singer of Live right there. And I turn to my date. I'm like, is that the lead singer of Live? And she's like, I don't know who that is. I'm like, okay, that really. And it took years before I finally figured it out because we didn't have IMDb or anything else like that. And finally, I confirmed it. Yes, that is Ed Kowalczyk playing the part of the waiter. Now, I got the full story behind it.
All right.
So he moves out to L.A. He's the only guy in the band that moves from Pennsylvania out to L.A., but he's out there being his rock star, and he has a friend who is a talent agent named Sean. And so they go to dinner one night and he's joking around with Sean and he's like, hey, I'm a big rock star now. You should get me into a movie. By the way, his only acting experience was playing Captain Hook in his school production of Peter Pan. And his buddy Sean is like, are you serious? And he's like, well, sure. Yeah, whatever. You know, no, not really. But okay. A couple of days later, Sean sends him the script for the movie Fight Club. And he's like, would you be interested in being this? And he said, I read it and was blown away at how good it was. I bought the book and read that and was blown away at how good it was. And so he's like, I don't know if I'm going to get this part or not, but I got to audition for this part, right? So he goes to audition for the part. And as it turns out, David Fincher, who he loves because he loved the game, David Fincher is a big fan of the band Live.
Oh, that's cool.
So... yeah. So the part that he was supposed to get, there's a scene where like this car attendant, it keeps spraying people as they walk by on the sidewalk trying to incite a fight. And then one of the guys he sprays is this preacher. And that was originally who Ed Kowalczyk was supposed to play. But David Fincher was like, no, I want you to have a talking part. And so he gives him this part of this waiter. And I don't think he says much more than, you know, it's like Helena Bonham Carter orders the soup and Ed Norton is like, just the clean ones. And he's like, then I suggest not that soup, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Whatever. I'll have the clam chowder, the fried chicken with the baked potato with everything and a chocolate chiffon pie.
Clean food, please.
In that case, sir, may I advise against the lady eating the clam chowder?
No clam chowder, thank you.
So he says he gets the part and David Fincher says, okay, have you seen The Shining? He's like, yeah. He says, go watch it again. Look at the bartender. I want you to be the bartender from The Shining when you're playing this waiter that's obviously a member of the Fight Club.
Wow. Great story, man. I remember that part of the movie now that you bring it up. So
yeah, I think like there's rumors out there that he had gotten the part because Brad Pitt was a big live fan, but he said, I never even met Brad Pitt because he wasn't the scene. He said that scene, that small little scene, they shot for 14 hours because David Fincher won't edit as he's going. He just shoots the whole scene over and over and over again, like 50 times. And he said he spent most of the time hanging out with Helena Bonham Carter smoking cigarettes. And she's like, so how do you like acting? And he says, I like being in a band.
Yeah. Yeah.
When they finally got to see the movie, like before everybody else, it was him, his buddy Sean, and Meatloaf.
And Meatloaf. Who has a part in that movie?
His name was Robert Paulson.
All right. Last song on the album. This song is called Horse.
2, 3, 4.
All the things that they make you say.
Out the country on this post grunge.
Yeah.
I love it. Steel guitar in there. Man, I dig it.
It sounds like the song you put it in of an album. It sounds like this is closing it off. We're just going to play something a little different, kind of like Van Halen used to do with their, you know, Happy Trail song, that kind of stuff. That's what it reminded me of. It's a cool little tune. I think James and them should cover it since Hidden Tracks would be covering a hidden track. That'd be a great song.
Perfect.
Hidden Tracks.
James Buckley and Hidden Tracks should cover this hidden track. Of Horse.
This sounds like a song that Sandra What's-Her-Face should have played at the end of Any Which Way You Can.
This is so much better than anything she could have. I remember when we were covering Huey Lewis in the News and they end it with a Hank Williams song. And you were like, why am I listening to this? I want to go back to the beginning and, you know, I want a new drug. And I'm like, no, dude, this is good. This is showing the range here.
By the way, we talked about how Live played Woodstock 94.
Yep.
Along with Green Day. And we're going to talk about Collective Soul next week. Friday, August 12th, 1994, on the North Stage. Live, then King's X, Sheryl Crow, Collective Soul, Candlebox, and Violent Femmes.
Nice.
That's a pretty solid day right there.
So interesting that you bring up Candlebox, because here's the post-release album, right? We get a few more albums after this. I really like the album that came after this, Secret Samandi. I bought that album. I loved it. But not nearly as much as I loved this one. But after they put out a few albums, eventually something goes wrong with these guys that have been playing together since they were 13 years old. And basically they fire, like Chad Taylor, Patrick Dahmer, and Chad Gracie, fire Ed Kowalczyk from the band.
Yeah. And he's like the main composer of all the songs.
And that was really what it was about. I think he was like, hey, you know, can I get like a songwriter, you know, bonus here since I really am the guy that's writing and singing all of this. I mean, I've got the melodies, I've got the lyrics. They just push him out of the band.
They're like, we didn't like you in the eighth grade.
Right. Well, as it turns out, like some other things happen and I kind of got the impression that maybe it's Chad Taylor kind of pushing the other guys around a little bit. It looked like he had some sort of bad business deal that he got sued over for misleading the person about his net worth. And Chad Gracie, the guy who was playing drums and with him since he was 13 years old, was like, he's just a liar. And there's really not much I can do to back him up when he's obviously and irrefutably lying in this scenario. So I think maybe Chad Taylor kind of tried to push them around. Now they stuck together and they partnered up with Kevin Martin and Sean Hennessy from Candlebox. And they formed a new band called The Gracious Few.
Okay.
I don't know that they had anything that was really that good. And obviously that one kind of fell apart after a while. But then Ed gets back with the band.
Ed gets back with the band and he somehow wrestles the majority of the ownership of the band away. Mm-hmm. And the first thing he does is fire Chad Taylor.
Yeah. And then not long after that, the other two guys are out too.
They're like, yeah, we're out of here.
Yeah, the band that is now live is just Ed and three other guys.
When you write all the songs, man, you got all the power.
Yeah. He was telling a story. Jason and I were listening to a story just before we started recording where he got a call. They were doing some very big show and their drummer had slipped on a banana peel, basically. I mean, it was really like, wait, are you serious? I mean, this sounds like a joke. Slipped on a banana peel? No, he slipped on a banana and broke his arm, which is important for a drummer.
You got to have your arms, unless you're Rick Allen.
Right. Well, apparently that's what the drummer did. Like, they had some other guy come in that was really good, but like they put two drummers up on the stage and their regular drummer played with one arm like Rick Allen, while the other one was kind of a backup fill.
Nice.
I don't know how it worked out, but I guess they had a good show.
I love it. Rick Allen, the Thunder God.
Yeah. Brad, what are your final thoughts on this one, man?
I mean, like I said earlier, it's one of my favorite albums of all time. It's top five for sure. I mean,
Wow.
Yeah. This album is obviously their best. I mean, it's solid the entire way through, start to finish, you know, any day. I don't have to be in any particular mood. I can listen to it. Very, very good album.
I like this album too. I do think it's top heavy. I think the front side is really, really strong. And I think it falls off on the second side, but there's some game changing bangers on the front side.
Can't argue with that. Yeah, like Brad said, this was the one that was on a top list of albums for me. I love it. I couldn't, when we very first started talking about this, and we've been talking about covering this album for years, it was going to be this one up against Collective Soul, the Blue Album. And it was only upon realizing, oh, hey, Dookie came out in 94. Oh, hey, 16 Stone came out in 94. Oh, my goodness. Weezer came out in 94. And then it was just a waterfall and we had to just pick five.
Right.
And so we went with these five. I'm anxious to cover Collective Soul, and then I'm really anxious to do the top five of 1994. I think it's going to be an epic episode.
I'm ready to listen to that Collective Soul episode as well. They're one of my favorites during that time, too. I actually got to go see them, I guess it was 3 years ago in Mississippi. They opened for Styx, and that was, both of those bands were incredible. That was a great show. Tommy Shaw came out and played with Collective Soul for a couple songs. And
fun.
Awesome. A really, really good show.
Well, you saw them with Jay Hudson over at the Riverwind, right?
I saw them about this time last year. Yep.
Nice. Nice.
Brad, thank you for being here, man. I hope you had a good time.
I did, man. Thanks for having me on. As always, I enjoyed it.
Great. Can't wait to talk next week, Collective Soul.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.